Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Peter V. Brett. Welcome to The World Shapers, where I have fascinating conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I, in this case, am your host, Edward Willett. I am also an author of science fiction and fantasy. My most recent novel from Daw Books, my ninth novel for Daw Books, is called World Shaper, and funnily enough, that's where this podcast gets its name from. Publishers Weekly gave it a starred review, calls it a rollicking secondary world contemporary fantasy. Booklist said that it's fun, quirky, and highly enjoyable, nicely laying the groundwork for future volumes, and I am currently writing the next volume in the series. It's called Master of the World. It will be out in September. World Shaper is currently out in trade paperback. It will be out in mass market paperback this summer, but before that, you'll be able to get it in audiobook format. That'll be coming up, I think, in February. And of course, it's available as an ebook as well. Other recent novels of mine include the science fiction novel The City Born from Daw Books, and a five-book young adult fantasy series called The Shards of Excalibur from Cateau Books. There's also a short story collection called Paths to the Stars that I recently published, and, of all things, an illustrated poetry collection, science fiction and fantasy poetry, of course, called I Tumble Through the Diamond Dust. If you'd like to find out more about my writing, you can find me at edwardwillett.com. That's W-I-L-L-E-T-T, edwardwillett.com, and you'll be able to read more than you probably want to know about me. So let's not talk about me anymore. Let's get on to this episode's guest, Peter V. Brett. Peter V. Brett is the internationally best-selling author of the Demon Cycle series, which has sold more than 3 million copies in 26 languages worldwide. Novels include The Warded Man, The Desert Spear, The Daylight War, The Skull Throne, and the final novel in the series, The Core. He lives in Brooklyn. So welcome to The World Shapers, Peter. Or do you prefer Pete?
Either one is fine.
Oh, well, I'll probably slip back and forth without thinking about it then.
And I won't even notice.
I seem to start a lot of these by saying, we met in Calgary. For some reason, I've met a lot of authors in Calgary, and you're one of the most recent ones, because we met at When Words Collide in Calgary this last summer, which is a convention I like to give a shout out to whenever I can, because I think it's a really good one. I hope you had a good time there.
Yeah, that was a fantastic convention. I didn't really know what to expect. I'd never been to it before and wasn't really familiar with it, but it actually ended up being one of the most welcoming and friendly and enjoyable conventions I've been to in a while. So,
and I think one of the nice things about it is that it's so focused on writing, and not just within science fiction fantasy, but all sorts of writing. So I think that's nice, from a change from just the typical science fiction convention or fantasy convention.
Yeah, I agree. And there are enough locals there who sort of know the area and are really welcoming, but then also like a lot of guests from all over. So it was a good mix. I really had a good time there.
Well,
maybe Canadians are just nicer.
Maybe. I'm both Canadian and American, so I can't really speak to that. We're going to talk, of course, about the Demon Cycle as we go ahead here, but I like to go back into the mists of time with my guests and find out how they got... First of all, how did you become interested in the fantastical? I understand it's from an older brother.
some of that, I think, is from my older brother. Some of it, I think, is just... when I reached the age where I was old enough to sort of read a novel, you know, on my own, the novel that happened to be at hand was The Hobbit. And so that, I think, was probably the first book without pictures that I ever read, like, of my own accord. And I think that definitely set me on the path. And then I had an older brother in the 80s who was playing Dungeons and Dragons, like, we were those kids in Stranger Things, playing Dungeons and Dragons. And so between the two, I think that I really got heavily invested in fantasy from an early age. And then when I started traveling to bookstores looking for things to read, I always ended up in the science fiction and fantasy section.
Yeah, I have two older brothers who both read the stuff, and that's kind of how I got hooked on it as well. Although, oddly enough, I tried reading The Hobbit as a kid. I couldn't get into it until I was quite a bit older. So my startup...
You couldn't do The Lord of the Rings until later.
Yeah. My startup stuff was Heinlein Juveniles and things like that, because I was more in the science fiction than the fantasy side when I... But I'm a bit older than you, too, so... So when did you actually start writing? And was it science fiction, fantasy from the beginning? Or were you, did you start writing and then sort of find your way into writing the fantastical stuff?
I started writing in high school. From an early age, I knew that I wanted to be a writer. At first, I wanted to write comic books. And so for a while, I was doing comic books. And then... probably in high school was when I realized that comic books are sort of a codependent relationship where you have to have a relationship with an artist or you have to do the art yourself in order to write comics. And so I had a friend that I was doing that with who just couldn't draw as fast as I could write and would often have opinions over how the story should go or like what should happen. And I liked being in control of everything, and I liked not having to be on someone else's schedule, so I sort of gravitated from there to prose. That's when I moved into science fiction and fantasy. The first book I wrote was a hybrid of the two. It was like a space fantasy. From there I went on to writing sort of basically like novelizations of D&D adventures, and then from there moved into sort of my own area.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nurshell, New York. I went to Nurshell High School. I wrote my first novel when I was 17. I finished it the beginning of my senior year of high school. It was terrible. It should never be published. Never will be published. I don't let anyone see it.
But you still have it.
I printed up 10 copies of it, and I like had them bound at the print shop, and I gave them out to my friends, and I have systematically hunted down and destroyed all of those copies, which I keep locked safely away.
I was going to ask you if you shared your writing. I wrote novels in high school, too, and I didn't make copies, but I had one copy that I typed up, and I handed around to people to read. And I often encourage starting writers to let other people read your stuff, because that's one way you find out whether you're telling stories that anybody wants to read or not. So did your friends actually enjoy it, even though you now think it's terrible?
Well, I mean, look, yeah, all my friends read it and had plenty to say about it and like acted like it was good. And like maybe for a 17-year-old it was good, but when I look back at it now, I just cringe. But yeah, you have to share your writing with people. Some people are content to just write for themselves and never show it to anyone, and that's fine. But if you want to be a writer, if you want to actually communicate to other people, you have to show it. You have to be willing to take the risk of showing it to other people.
Now, you went into university, you studied English, but you didn't particularly focus on creative writing, is that right?
Well, they didn't have a creative writing program at the school that I went to. I wanted to go to a state university because that was what we could afford. And so the one that I got into was the best one of the state universities that I applied to, but they didn't have a creative writing major. So I majored in English and just took all the writing classes I could and tried to craft my own writing major. Didn't really work out. I wouldn't say that my college education had a massive influence on my writing.
Well, most of the writers I've talked to who took creative writing don't really usually say very good things about the creative writing that they took, I've noticed. It's interesting, especially if they write science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, science fiction and fantasy is generally looked down on at the university level, which is undeserved, but nevertheless, it's the way of things. And so, like, I took a bunch of creative writing classes that were, like, poetry, even though I didn't really want to write poetry, or, like, that were literary fiction, even though literary fiction had always sort of bored me. There certainly weren't any science fiction and fantasy writing classes until later, after I graduated. I was living in New York City, and I took a science fiction and fantasy writing class as a night school continuing education class at NYU. And that class actually did help me in my career. I actually wrote the first chapter of The Warded Man in that class, you know, which ended up being what started my career off.
But there were a lot of years in there between that first novel at 17 and The Warded Man, weren't there?
Yeah, there were a lot of years and a lot of terrible novels. The Warded Man was my fifth novel. So I wrote four other novels prior to that that were terrible. You know, I mean, like each one was had good things in it. Like each one had things that I even to this day am proud of, but they also had a lot of cringeworthy, horrible things. But you need to get through that in order to write on a professional level. And so every writer that I know, every professional writer that I know has a few, you know, corpses of books left in their wake that have never seen the light of day and never should see the light of day.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. And I started writing as high school and didn't actually sell anything. And even then it wasn't too much of a publisher for about the same time span that you were talking about. Between when you, so yeah, lots of bad writing in there. You're learning all the time.
I didn't even try to get anything published until I was 35. I looked at my own work and sort of was my own harshest critic and didn't feel that I was writing on a professional level, so I wasn't attempting to sell it. I was waiting to either get bored of doing it or to hit that point where I started to feel like I was in control and really knew what I was doing.
What were you doing for a living in there?
I had a degree in English, and so I knew that I wanted to be a writer, and so I moved to New York City, and I took, like, the first editorial-related job I could find. And so I started out editing business-to-business directories, which essentially means editing phone books, which is exactly as fun as it sounds. From there, I got a job as an assistant editor doing medical journals. And so I did that for a little over a year. And from that, I went on to get an editorial job doing pharmaceutical publishing. So basically, like, we would send journalists to medical conferences, and they would cover presentations there and write up reports that we would publish and mail out to doctors and nurses and things like that. And so that basically became my career. I did that for almost 10 years and was doing very well. You know, I made a good living. I had good insurance. I was able to do the work with, like, only a small percentage of my overall, like, brain processing power. So I didn't really take my work home with me. I would go to work and I would work a full day and I would go home and sort of forget about it until I went back. And so it was a passable career that I could have gone on to do for the rest of my life. But all along at night, I was working on my novels and sort of hoping that that could at least turn into something. And it eventually, I was fortunate enough to have it turn into my full-time career.
Yes, it worked out well for you. That sort of nonfiction, pharmaceutical writing, all that stuff you were doing, do you find that had benefit when it comes to writing fiction, or were they completely separate things for you?
It did. It had a big benefit, I think, but in ways that were sort of unforeseen. I mean, certainly I was wearing all of the editorial hats, and so I was an editor who was, like, assigning stories to journalists, and then I was talking to them about, like, the sort of theme of their story, and then I was doing first and second pass edits of that story, but then there were a bunch of other editors, and we would trade with each other. You know, I would do copy edits on their stories, and they would do copy edits on my stories. And then, you know, for a third editor, we would do a proofread. And so because of that, I sort of had to wear all the hats. So I learned the proofreader's job and how it's different from the copy editor's job. I learned the copy editor's job and how it's different from the regular editor's job. And I did project management, and I did art direction, and I did print production, and we made promotional items, and we built websites for our clients. And so I learned how to do a wide variety of publishing and marketing things. Because I was working in this sort of like small boutique publishing company, like I got to learn how to do all of those things. And so I don't think any of that really affected my my prose. So I don't know that it affected like the content of the book so much, but the editing skills allowed me to deliver a really clean manuscript to my agent for the initial hurdle, and also to the publishers when we were trying to sell it. And then once I managed to sell the series, I had a whole set of skills that I was able to apply to promoting myself. I knew how to build a website. I knew how to make promotional items. I knew how to art direct. So I was able to hire artists to, you know, provide content for my website and provide content for my social media feeds and make me professional looking business cards and all sorts of things like that. And so all of those skills definitely had a positive effect on my career overall, although I don't know that any of them really affected the stories themselves.
It sounds like, of course, when this started, it wasn't as big a thing as it is now, but had you chosen to with those skills, you could probably have done quite well within the self-published world as well as the traditional published world.
Absolutely. I think that being a success in self-publishing requires a certain skill set, and it's a skill set that, to be honest, most people don't have. The people who do have it, though, can be very successful in that realm, and I think that career that I had in medical publishing and marketing gave me most of those skills, but also gave me an appreciation of just how much work all of those things are. And in the end, I decided that I would much rather have a traditional publisher do all of that stuff for me so that I could just focus on the creative part rather than take on all of the additional headaches of marketing and print production and mailing and you know, selling myself and establishing mailing lists and there's so many things that you have to do to have a successful career in self-publishing that I think that I'm capable of doing, but I don't want to do. I'd much rather focus on writing stories and you know, doing sort of fan outreach.
So while you were doing all your fiction writing, while you're doing this during the day, and then you were writing the unpublished novels, were you also doing things like writing workshops, or were you in a writer's group? Who encouraged you during all that time?
I never was in a formal writing group or writing workshop. I had my best friend, Mike Cole, is a science fiction and fantasy author.
Yes,
as well.
I hope to have him on the show at some point.
Well, I could probably make that happen. he and I have been best friends. We met in high school, but we've been best friends since college. And so we both wanted to be writers, and we were both sort of reading each other's work and editing each other's work and encouraging each other's work from the beginning. And that, I think, was a big help to both of us. And if you look at our first novels, there's a lot of his influence in my early novels, and there's a lot of my influence in his early novels, because we were passing them back and forth to each other and offering ideas. And so that, for the most part, was my creative partnership. And Mike is also a much more social person than I am, and so he was very keyed into sort of the New York publishing scene and getting invited to parties with other authors, and he joined the Science Fiction Writers of America and had connections there, and so like I was the introvert that he adopted to sort of break into that world. And so those connections certainly paid off later. But I spent most of that time that he spent building that network, I spent that time focused on my writing and trying to get up to a level where I was willing to risk putting it out there.
Well, we're going to talk in more detail about the Demon Cycle. First, I guess, how do you describe them to people who unimaginably have never read any of them?
The Demon Cycle books are set in a world where demons rise out of the ground each night and basically ravage the land. They will hunt and kill any living thing, but their main focus and preference is humans. And so these creatures are magical and immortal and mostly immune to regular weapons. And so the only way to protect yourself is to draw these magical symbols called wards around your home, around your crops, around your property, to form a barrier of protection that the demons can't pass through, sort of like holding up a cross to a vampire. And so the book begins 300 years after these demons have sort of reappeared in the world and knocked what was once a very technologically advanced society down to about Little House on the Prairie level of technology. Humanity has been hunted nearly to extinction. And so when the story begins, there are very few people left. They live in very isolated communities, and it's really hard to get from one place to another because anytime you travel overnight, you run the risk of being attacked by demons. The series follows a group of characters, each of whom we meet in their childhood, and each of whom is scarred by some sort of demon encounter in their childhood that pushes them off what would have been the normal path of their life and forces them down a different path. And each one of them learns sort of a different way to resist the demons and start learning how to fight back. And that, as they grow up into adulthood, becomes this sort of last push for humanity to fight back from the brink of extinction and sort of make a comeback.
And it's a 5-book series.
It's a 5-book series, and the last book is out, so it's a finished series. So if you're the sort of person who likes to wait until a series is done to give it a chance, you can binge the whole thing right now. There's 5 books, and then there's 4 companion novellas that aren't really essential to the main story, but if you're enjoying the main story, they are nice little side adventures that give you more development of some of the less some of the secondary characters in the series.
So what was the initial spark? Where did you get your idea? That's the classic.
The thing is, this question is always the hardest to answer because any real author knows that you don't just get an idea like a book is full of many, 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 many ideas. And so, I don't think that there was any one thing that made me start writing the series. It was more something that built up over time. I like, one of my favorite books ever was The Elfstones of Shannara by Terry Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And that story, very similarly, was about demons coming back into the world after having been banished for thousands of years, and how the world wasn't really ready for them. You know, they'd forgotten how to fight them. They'd basically forgotten that they exist. And so suddenly these demons are coming back and people just don't know how to deal with it and aren't prepared for it. And so that, I think, was a big influence in my storytelling. But it was only a tiny part of the puzzle. I mean, I also, spent a long time building a magic system that I thought worked. I'm sorry if there's a little banging. They're doing work outside of my window.
Yeah, I figured that. It's a very New York sound, so.
Yeah. I didn't expect them to be hanging, literally outside of my window. But then I think what really made the story click for me was September 11th. I was in New York City on September 11th, and really, I could see the towers burning from my office window see people running around on the streets and everybody was terrified. My father-in-law at the time was in the World Trade Center at the time of the attack. I mean, he was evacuated, but we didn't know that at the time. We didn't have the sort of cell phone technology that we do now where you can get right in touch with somebody and see if they're okay. It took hours before we found out. And so all of this had the effect of me seeing how fear and terror affected a large group of people. some people immediately ran away. Some people said, I have to get home to my family, and they, like, ran out of the building and went home. And some people just said, okay, we have to move away from wherever the smoke and the fire is. And other people said, no, we have to run to the smoke and the fire and help people. And there were people lining up down the street to give blood, and there were people rushing into the wreckage to try and help people out and clear it out. And there were other people who were just standing around bewildered and not knowing what to do. And there were other people who, you know, went and needed to go somewhere and cry. And there were other people who threw up their hands and said, oh, well, the subways are screwed and we're not going anywhere, so we might as well get a, you know, six pack of beer and wait this out. And so that, the way that every one of those people was afraid, but they all dealt with it differently, was something that really struck me, and something that I think became the basis of that first book, which was that, like, there are all these people who are living in fear every night as the demons come out. How does that make them behave? What are the different ways that that individuals deal with that fear? How do you treat your neighbor when you know that both of you might get eaten by demons that night? How do you treat your friends? How do you treat your family? How do you treat the people that you're sort of locked up with at night because you can't go anywhere until the sun comes up? And those were some of the ideas that I really explored in that first book that made it more than just like a legend or a myth. It made it something that really felt real and visceral and hopefully draws a reader in and makes them feel like they're part of what's going on.
Well, it certainly drew me in, so I can vouch that you succeeded in that.
Well, thank you.
Where did the symbol-based magic system, why did you go that route? Do you remember?
Well, I think that the magical symbols that offer protection from evil are something that every culture in the world shares. Even cultures that sort of evolved independently of each other have their own version of the evil eye or the cross that holds back a vampire or whatever. And so I was dealing with these sort of big concepts that everybody can understand. Fear of the monsters that come out in the dark, the magical symbols that you hope will protect you. Like, and so I wanted to have magic in the series, but I didn't want magic to be something that people depended on overly. I wanted the series to be sort of very much grounded in the real world, but then have this sort of magical element that you could understand and the reader can understand to the point where they would understand that magic wasn't going to just suddenly save the day unexpectedly in a way that wasn't satisfying. Because there's a lot of fantasy books that where magic's just sort of like at the end, it's like, oh, the good guys won and it was magic and that's great. I very much didn't want that. I wanted a magic system where people knew the rules so that they could understand that something unexpected wasn't going to happen. But also be sort of surprised when that magic system was used in creative ways that maybe they hadn't thought of. And I did it in such a way that it could be built up over the course of the series, so that in the first book there's very little magic other than these sort of protective symbols. But then by the end of the series, when people are throwing lightning bolts around and flying, like, the reader understands it because you got there like through a very slow incremental way where with each step and each advancement and like the understanding of how the magic system worked, the reader was going along for the ride. So that you got there gradually enough that when it got spectacular, it didn't seem out of nowhere.
Well, and that is, of course, one of the challenges of writing a series, especially one that builds to a conclusion. I presume that you had the outline of the entire five-book cycle when you began, or did you develop some of it as you went along?
My original pitch to Random House was for five books, and I delivered to them a completed first book, maybe 30% of a second book, plus extensive notes on how it would end. Probably about 3 pages on what would happen in the third book, 1 page on what would happen in the fourth book, and then 1 paragraph on what happened in the final book. But I'm happy to say that 10 years later, I hit that paragraph pretty much exactly. So it's nice to know that, like, even when you sort of take a shot in the dark, years later, I was able to hit the target anyway.
Did you have the book titles before you started, or did they come as you went along?
I had a set of titles, not all of which ended up getting used. Sometimes when you're writing a big series like that, you have these story beats that you want to hit, and you think you're going to hit them in a certain rhythm, and then that rhythm changes as the series goes along. And so, some things that I thought were going to happen in book two didn't happen until book three, and some things that I thought were going to happen in book three didn't happen until book four. And so the titles needed to be a little fluid to deal with that.
Now, I think I read that you're a fairly detailed outliner of books before you begin. Is that the case? What do your outlines look like?
Ridiculously outlined. My book outlines can be 150 pages,
Oh.
where I will write down literally everything that happens in the story. Like every chapter will be broken down to say, okay, this chapter opens up with this person's POV, and section one of the chapter this happens, section two of the chapter this happens, section three of the chapter this happens, and it ends on this note, and and then that is the shift that brings us to this other character, who starts off in a similar way that picks up that beat. And so I do that throughout the entire book so that I know the entire story. Like before I sit down and start writing the prose of the story, I know exactly how the story is going to go. And that is essential to me because I don't run the risk of writing myself to a corner. I know exactly how the story is going to go, and so then I can spend my prose time focusing on the character's emotional state, how do they feel about what's happening. I already know what's going to happen. Like, what state of mind does that put them in? How does that affect how they treat each other? Like, how does that affect their emotional state? What is the relationships between the characters like as they go through this or that trying event? And so that is sort of how I approach the prose portion of the writing. And so a lot of the creative questions and problem solving is done in the planning stage, and then a lot of the emotional writing is done in the prose stage.
See, a lot of authors will tell me that they don't like to do a detailed outline because then they feel like they've already written the book and then it just becomes a slog actually writing the book. Does it feel like that to you, or do you find
It
that the
absolutely does, but this is the mistake that I think a lot of writers make, is that they think that their job should be fun. And you know what? It doesn't have to be fun. Writing is your job, and the way that gets you to the best end product is the way that you should do it. If you're writing because it's fun, like, that's fine, but I think that if that's not the method that produces the best work for you, then it doesn't always have to be fun. So there's a lot of times where I do feel like, okay, I've sucked all the joy out of this story because I've already solved all the problems and done all the discovery, and now I'm just doing the hard work part. But a job should involve some hard work, every artist, has to spend time doing tedious tasks in addition to the very creative parts of things. And so I don't resent that because I think that it gets me to the end point that I want to be at, which is a book that I'm really proud of.
During the discovery process, when you're doing the outlining, clearly where you will be deciding what characters will be doing what, how do you decide who you need in a story, and then how do you go about bringing them to life? You have multiple viewpoint characters, multiple antagonists, I guess you could call them, people who we follow throughout and get to know. It's not like it's always just the one guy. So you have a lot of interesting characters. So how do you decide who you need and who's going to be telling the story, and how do you bring them to life?
Well, I sort of think of my series as a series of character studies going on at this sort of pivotal part of history. So there's this great upheaval as humanity tries to fight its way back from extinction, And I'm exploring the interesting people who are involved in that. And so each one of those characters is completely different from all of the others, and each one of them has their own story and their own sort of path to achieving agency in this world. And those stories are as interesting to me as the overall overarching stories. So, you know, like you have this, like, you know, series of origin stories that all sort of build up to this, you know, group of characters that, you know, reaches the final battle, as it were. And so I sort of like wrote out stories that I thought were interesting and characters that I thought were interesting. And then I said, like, okay, let's take your sort of typical hero characters. And then instead of focusing on them when they're adults and they're already awesome, why don't we go back and look at them when they're children and sort of see how they got there? And that's what's interesting to me. And as the series progresses, like, there are a lot of times when I'll, like, take a character and say, okay, we're going to jump back a few years and you're going to see where this person came from and the trials that they went through when they were younger, so that when they encounter something similar as an adult, you understand why they decide to do what they decide to do. And I think it's a lot more satisfying in that way. Because when you know where a character came from, then you can understand why they make decisions that might be different from what you would have made under those circumstances.
I notice on your website that you have, on the About page about you, you actually have a character sheet for yourself. Does that match up what you do with your characters, or is that just a visual fun element for your website?
That was something that, honestly, that was something that I did as a goof for the website when I first made it. You know, this was at the very beginning of my career when I had no reason to think that this was going to be even a full-time job, much less any kind of success. And so I just did this. I thought it would be funny to do, like, I did two things. I did a Dungeons & Dragons character sheet about myself, and I did a Marvel Universe entry. So Marvel Universe was this book in the 80s. It was basically like a encyclopedia of all of the superheroes and supervillains in the Marvel Universe that you could sort of refer to. And I love those books because it would give you, like, all of the background information on every single character, like whether they're a bit character or a big hero, and would allow you to say, like, oh, you know, like the Fantastic Four are fighting Annihilus. And obviously there's a lot of history there, but I don't have those older issues, and, you know, it's pre-internet age and I can't really look it up, but I can go look up Annihilus in Marvel Universe and see what his deal is. And so I used to spend a lot of time reading those books, and I think that certainly influenced my writing. And so I made this entry in the same format as those old Marvel Universe entries, like, about myself.
Known associations and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, like his alias and group affiliations and superpowers but those were, it was really just a goof. Like, none of that was expected to go anywhere, really.
What's your actual writing process look like? I remember reading, and I've read other times, that you actually write and wrote The Warded Man quite a bit while commuting, didn't you?
Yeah. That first book, I submitted it to an agent. And at that point, I was kind of at a stage where I wasn't sure if I was going to ever be published. You know, I was in my 30s already, and, like, I thought that I was getting too old for this sort of thing, and submitted the book to an agent, and he rejected it. But he asked if I had anything else, and so I showed him one of my older books, and he rejected that too. But he said, look, you've got a lot of potential, but it's clear that your writing is self-taught and you're making a lot of amateur mistakes. And he gave me a book on writing and told me to read it and said, go back and take that first book. It was called The Painted Man back then. He's like, take that book and fix it and then come back to me. And so at this point, I had like a real legit agent who represented best-selling authors telling me, like, I had what it took if I would just get some focus. But at the time, like, I had a full-time job in Times Square, New York City, and I lived out in Brooklyn, and so I had 2-hour commute each day, plus my time at work, and I also, like, had a love life and friends and everything else, and didn't really have a lot of writing time. And so I decided that I would give up my reading time on my morning and afternoon commute and try and spend that time writing. And so I bought a smartphone. This was like pre-iPhone. I bought a Windows phone that had a very broken down version of Microsoft Word. And I broke the book into separate chapters. And I would get on the subway in the morning and I would open up the chapter that I was working on and I would put my headphones on and for 45 minutes to an hour, I would write on the way to work, and I would do the same thing on the way home, and I would write maybe 300 or 400 words on the way to work and 300 or 400 words on the way back. And then at night, I would sync that back to my computer, and I would fix all the typos from writing with my thumbs and add another couple hundred words, so I would average around 1,000 words a day. And I did that for a year. I would say probably 60% of The Warded Man was written on the subway like that in that first year, and a decent portion of The Desert Spear as well. After that, I got an office and started writing in a more traditional fashion, but I still make sure that all of my mobile devices are writing capable, so that if I'm out and about somewhere and I want to get some writing in, I can do it pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, I did a lot of writing on a phone as well, only I had a little fold-up Bluetooth keyboard so I could do proper typing on it. But I wrote a book called Mar Seguro, which won the Aurora Award in 2009. I largely wrote that in this little tiny fold-up keyboard on my phone. So that was one reason that story, when I first saw an interview with you not long after The Warded Man came out, I thought, oh, I'm not the only one that writes on a phone. So,
well, I mean, it's good to remember that writing is not something that needs to be contained in a certain ritual or in a certain place or with a certain device. You can do it pretty much anywhere.
Lots of people still like to write longhand. I can't do it myself, but I've talked to some who do.
I don't understand that, but I mean, for me, it's just the worry that, like, what if you lose those pages? You know, like, what if you, like, spill your drink on it and they all blur? Like, what if the wind blows them away? What if you forget your bag somewhere? Then everything's lost.
And what if you can't read your own writing?
yeah. And so that's what worries me more than anything else. My daughter is writing a novel, and she's writing it longhand in a notebook that she carries with her everywhere. And I live in terror that one day she's going to lose that notebook and lose, you know, a year of work, more than a year at this point. But, you know, I don't want to transfer all of my anxieties onto her. So
Once you have an now, because of the way you work with the very, very detailed outline, I'm going to make a guess that there's not a lot of rewriting when you get to the end of the book. Is that fair, or do you actually have to do quite a bit of prose retouching up?
I mean, I don't want to lie and say that I don't have to do rewriting. I mean, I don't tend to write myself into a corner. I usually will write one book all the way through to the end and then turn it in to my agent and my editor, and usually Mike Cole do a read too. And then I do a read myself, and then all four of those people will deliver their own sort of edited manuscript, and I will go through them all simultaneously and make sort of a master edit copy that sort of breaks down what I need to work on, and then I do one rewrite from beginning to end to fix all of the problems. There's always a lot of rewriting to do, but it's usually like, you told instead of showed in this section, or you got lazy here and did a shortcut to get to the interesting part, but you still have to go back and fill in all of these details to make this make sense, or like, you know, this emotional encounter doesn't feel right, these characters, you know, might not have acted that way, or like, so it's rare that I have to go out and delete a whole section or change something really significant with regards to the path of the story. You know, I've never had to like change the ending or something like that. But there are a lot of times where my writing was lazy because I was distracted or because I was more excited to get to a different part and I like jumped ahead, or because I just was telling and not showing in the first draft. I do that a lot in the first draft. So that's the second draft is always massively different and massively better, but structurally it's mostly the same. But on the individual, like every sentence has been touched and improved. You know, usually I'll go through and take 2 to 3 words out of every sentence. And 2 sentences out of every paragraph, you know, and so like I streamline a lot. I make things a lot tighter, and occasionally I'll expand a little bit if there was a scene missing that I needed to add in. But I do all of that in one pass, and then usually that second draft is the final draft.
Have you had the same editor for the entire series?
No, actually, I'm on my third editor, which is somewhat frustrating. My first editor was laid off when Random House combined. They had multiple science fiction and fantasy imprints, and they sort of combined them all into one, into Del Rey. And so my editor was a casualty of that. And so then I was assigned another editor, but she had been assigned a huge pile of novels from different authors at the same time. You know, like as some editors were laid off, the other editors got about a bunch of extra work added onto them. And so this editor was swamped, and she was a great editor, but I also feel like she just didn't have the she wasn't the one who had acquired my books. She didn't have the sort of passion for them that I had. And so on the third book, I shifted editors again to Trisha Narwani, who is the managing editor at Delray Books. And she's been my editor for the last 3 books. And we have an excellent relationship. And she's been wonderful and has really helped make the books better.
Something I've thought about. I mean, I've written a much smaller 5-book series with the books only 60,000 words each. So that's like, what, 2 of yours? 1 of yours?
But that's basically like slightly more than 1 of my books.
Exactly. Yeah. But even with that, there's always a certain continuity problem, keeping track of details. Now, maybe because of your detailed outlines, does that make that easier for you? So you can look back at an outline or something more easily if there's a name or a description or something that you have to recall, or is it just me that has that problem?
Well, I'm sort of an obsessive writer. I write. There's basically 3 files that I have at any given time, which is the outline file, which I call the step sheet. There's the actual prose file, and then there's my appendices file, where I basically create a glossary that lists every thing that I've made up in the story. So every person, place, or thing, every distance between 2 points, every the bestiary of magical creatures, like the currency systems and individuals' locations, like all of that stuff is put into one big appendix file that is searchable, so that if I have questions or if I forget something, I have a way to look them up.
Smart.
And so that has been extremely helpful to me to give me a solid reference point.
More of us should do that, I think.
Well, again, I mean, it's one of those things that takes the fun out. And so if you're the type of author who needs the fun, then that can be a problem. But it certainly is an advantage to have that to refer to.
Well, and you've written novellas that are kind of set in the same world and, you know, shorter pieces. I would think that'd be very helpful to, well, even as an idea generator to have all this detailed information to see where there are places where stories could be told about other elements of the world that aren't part of the main cycle. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, and I sort of have a running list of those story ideas that I keep handy. So that, I've only written four of those novellas, but I have plots for maybe another four or five of them that I just will do when I have time to do. I always have sort of a running list of I never got to explore down that side road because I was busy getting to this, I was building towards this thing, and so I kept heading towards that, but I had this cool idea to explore what's over there, and I make a note, and then I never get around to it. And so those stories are always just sort of waiting for their chance to be told.
Well, I'm going to get the big philosophical questions here as we get close to the end here. Why do you write? Why do you think any of us write? And particularly, why do you think you and others write fantasy? What is the reason? Why do we do this?
I think that every person, in order to maintain sanity and good mental health, needs to have some creative outlet. And it's different for all of us. I mean, some of it is what you're naturally inclined towards doing. Some of the things are what your skill set is based on, your personal makeup. And so, for some people it's art, for some people it's quilting, so for some people it's fashion, for some people it's music, and for me it was writing. Whether it's something that you do professionally or something that you do as a hobby, I really think that without that, we stagnate. And so that was a big part of why I did it. And also that, I like the idea that my books will outlast me, the sense that, after I'm gone, here's something I did that will hopefully stick around and be remembered and be a way to remember me in a fashion. So there's an immortality that comes with being published that I certainly reach for. As for why fantasy is what I love. Fantasy is what I enjoy. I mean, if that first book that I had read was Sherlock Holmes or Tarzan or H.G. Wells or something, maybe what I write would be different. But my first book was The Hobbit, and that really sort of set the tone for what I like to read. And so that's why I do it, I think.
What do you think the appeal of fantasy is for readers?
I think it lets us explore things that we might not otherwise be able to. Writing in a fantasy world gives me the ability to talk about a lot of real-world things, but in a once-removed fashion that doesn't point a finger at anyone individually or anything individually. So I can talk about religion, I can talk about politics, I can talk about culture, I can talk about all sorts of things, gender relations, but I can do it in a way where no one can say I'm talking about them in particular. And so that, I think, gives me a lot of freedom to explore and discuss things. I think that the magical world is somewhere where our brains go naturally. And I think that is something that's always, it's part of everyone's childhood in one way or another, and something that I really liked exploring and playing with. And, I don't know. I think that fairy tales still have a lot to tell us in the modern world, and tell us a lot about ourselves and about the world around us.
Well, so you kind of touched on the next thing I was going to ask, which is what impact do you want your stories to have on readers? What do you want them to go away with? This podcast is called The World Shapers, and you've shaped a very detailed and fascinating world. But by having readers in our world read it, are you hoping that in some fashion you're shaping them or shaping our world in some way?
I mean, I guess. I don't want to be too hubristic as to claim that I have some ulterior motive to shape people's worldview or outlook or anything, but I do think that one of the things that I do in my books is take a character that you think you understand in one book and then do a deep dive into them in the next book and make the readers realize that they didn't really know that person at all. The character who was set up to be the villain in the first book is the hero and protagonist of the second book. And by the time a couple of chapters go by, you're rooting for them and want them to succeed. And that is something that I did multiple times. And I think that if it teaches anything, it's that whether someone is the hero or the villain is very often a matter of perspective. And people can have the same goals, saving the world, being a good leader, protecting your people. And depending on which side of the fence you're on, the same person could be a hero or a villain. And what I hope is that when what people take away from that is that maybe they shouldn't be so quick to judge people that they don't really know very well. That was something that was a really major theme for me, especially during those early years after 9/11, when the United States was getting into a war that we didn't really understand with people that we hadn't bothered to research, and making a lot of really stupid mistakes. And so that's something that I wanted to explore a little and give a sense of, like, all right, maybe if you'd taken the time to understand what you were doing, you would have done things differently. It's definitely a theme in the books.
And you finished the 5-book series. What's next?
I've got another 3-book series that I've started. The first book is called The Desert Prince. It should be out probably in very early 2019. The series will take place in the same world as the Demon Cycle books, but 15 years later, and we'll have a new cast of characters. Like, some of the older characters may show up for a cameo, but for the most part, it's going to be all new characters and explore different parts of the world that we didn't really get a close look at in the first series. You won't need to have read the older series to read the new series, but those people who have, you know, will have a different take on it than people who come in as new readers.
And when will those start to appear, do you think?
The first one is due summer of next year, and so it'll probably be out in early 2019. And then I'm hoping they'll be out more or less once a year after that. First one's always the hardest.
Yeah. And where can people find you online if they want to, you know, keep in touch with what you're up to?
I'm on most of the social media feeds under the username PVBrett, PVBRETT. So Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, all of those use the same username, PVBrett. Or you can just go to www.petervbrett.com, and everything's linked there as well. I keep a fairly active blog showing fan art. I run a lot of giveaway contests because I have a small New York apartment and don't have a place for all of the books that publishers send me. Like, every publisher is required to send me 20 copies of each edition of each book. And if I don't give them away, they quickly pile up on me. And so I very regularly run giveaway contests for signed books.
Yeah. Author found crushed in apartment under own free copies of books.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So thanks so much for being on The World Shapers. I hope you enjoyed it. I sure did.
Yeah, it was a great time. Thank you so much for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
So thanks again to Peter V. Brett for being on The World Shapers. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. We have many more great... there's that we again. I keep saying we. It's that editorial we. I have many more great guests lined up just this week. As this one goes live, I'll be talking to best-selling author Tosca Lee and also to Tad Williams. So there's a couple to look forward to coming up. I've recently spoken with Thuria Dyer and David John Butler, so those are in the works as well, and many more to come after that. Once again, you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can follow The World Shapers on Twitter at The World Shapers, and you can also find The World Shapers on Facebook. Just search up The World Shapers. It's very easy. You can find me on Twitter at E Willett, again, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me online at edwardwillett.com, edwardwillett with two T's, .com. And you can also find me on Facebook. Just search up Edward Willett, or if you prefer, E.C. Blake, one of my pseudonyms, which also has a page on there. E.C. Blake is also on Twitter, by the way, at author E.C. Blake. Although, oddly enough, he tends to tweet pretty much the same things that Edward Willett does. So that's it for this episode of The World Shapers. I had a great time. I hope you did, too. Please come back and listen to many more of these interviews with science fiction and fantasy authors talking about the creative process of The World Shapers. Bye for now.